Case number 12-5286, Securities and Exchange Commission Appellant versus Securities Investor Protection Corporation. Mr. Avery for the appellant, Mr. McConnell for the appellee.
Thank you. If it pleases the court, this case arises out of the Securities Investor Protection Act of 1970, which was enacted to provide for liquidations of brokerage firms under certain circumstances, for example, insolvency of the firm. And it also provides some measure of security in the nature of a fund maintained by SIPC for people who have securities or cash being held for them by the brokerage firm. This case, however, is not a garden variety SIPC liquidation. Rather, it arises out of a massive Ponzi scheme which was orchestrated by a fellow named Alan Stanford.
Can I just ask one, sort of maybe unrelated to the arguments, but I'm not exactly sure. Is this brokerage not going to be liquidated one way or the other? That is?
It's in receivership right now, Your Honor.
Right.
And if there's no SIPC liquidation, there's no SIPC coverage, and any customers of the brokerage are treated as general creditors of the brokerage,
but still,
they would get special treatment.
I understand. It's a difference with respect to priorities and obviously a difference with respect to whether SIPC owes them money. But the assets of the brokerage are going to be distributed one way or the other, aren't they, if there are any?
Yes. No. Yes, as far as I know, that would absolutely be the case. Stanford conducted his scheme through a number of entities, all wholly owned by him, including, in this case, a brokerage firm named Stanford Group Company, or SGC, which was also a member of SIPC. The SGC brokers encouraged investors to open accounts with the brokerage. By the way, I should mention, this was actually a pretty large operation. I think, if memory serves, there were 31 offices throughout the United States in something like 13 different states. And the brokers encouraged their investors to buy what they said were valuable certificates of deposit, supposedly issued by another Stanford entity, the Stanford International Bank. In fact, the bank was just a shell, and the so-called CDs were worthless. It was a Ponzi scheme. When the scheme finally collapsed, as I said, a receiver was appointed, and the first thing the receiver did, maybe not the first thing, one of the things the receiver did was to ask SIPC whether there was any SIPC coverage the investors who invested through the brokerage. And SIPC concluded.
Now, when you say, let me ask a mechanical question. So when you say invested through the brokerage, what does that mean exactly? Did the investors have funds with SGC that then were used to buy the SIBL CDs, or were the funds somewhere else?
As I understand it, there were two ways that investors could invest at the urging of these brokers. I think they called themselves financial advisors. In one case, the investors actually had funds on deposit, funds or securities, other securities on deposit in a brokerage account. Now the account
with SGC.
It's in effect with SGC. In fact, it's held by what's called a clearing broker. In this case, a company called Pershing.
But is Pershing part of the Stanford complex of companies?
No.
So then it's not. I mean, I don't know what you mean by in effect then, because it's outside the Stanford operation altogether.
Well, you probably keep your cash in the bank account, but it's still your cash. These customers had their money in a brokerage account with SGC that was held in custody at Pershing for
none
a while.
But none of your theory involves Pershing being part of the Ponzi scheme, right?
No, that's absolutely correct.
So none of your arguments about consolidating the different companies or Equitable
has nothing to do with Pershing.
It's
nothing to do with Pershing.
So you're not relying in any way on the fact that the money was deposited with Pershing?
For a while.
You're not relying on it for a while?
No, it was deposited for Pershing. It was in custody of Pershing for a while.
So I think that Judge Srinivasan's question is, was any of it deposited in the Stanford company, in the Stanford brokerage?
The Stanford brokerage, as far as we know, did not physically hold the money, the cash. They weren't equipped to. It had to go somewhere to a financial institution that was equipped to hold it, and that was Pershing.
So this is what I was confused, because that seems to be the predicate of the whole case. But then there's allusions at points in the record to the effect that the investors had money on account, maybe I'm using the wrong terminology, but had money with SGC, and that money was then used to buy the SIBL CDs. And if you look, for example, I'm looking at Joint Appendix 232, it's an affidavit. And this person says, I opened a Stanford Group Company brokerage account for the purpose of purchasing two Stanford International Bank certificates of deposit. And then goes on to say, Stanford Group Company directed Pershing to wire $700,000 from my SGC brokerage account. So there's at least some indication that investors had money with SGC. But then that doesn't appear to be part of your theory.
Well, with SGC, but held by Pershing. That's why they had to give wire instructions.
I see. So that money was actually physically located with Pershing.
This was some of the investors. Other investors.
Can I just cross over these investors? My understanding of your theory with respect to these investors, the ones we're just talking about, is that they thought and were misrepresented but told that their money was with SGC. Is that right? Or are you not making even that?
I don't think that's particularly relevant. They were brought into the scheme by SGC.
Some of the cases that you're relying on, Primeline, those other cases, do take something from investors thinking that the money that they've deposited with a non-broker was actually deposited with a broker. And I thought part of your argument, at least in the analysis of the SEC, was that you were going to rely in part on that kind of theory. Is that wrong? I mean, it's quite possible I'm wrong. It won't be the first time.
I feel confident the investors, your average investor, would not have paid any attention to the existence of Pershing with an entity with which it had no particular contact until it was told to give a wire instruction to Pershing. It was dealing with SGC.
Here's my question. I mean, you seem to be abandoning an argument that was made in the analysis. At JA 243, it says, additionally, as in Old Naples, there are facts that would have led SGC account holders who purchased civil CDs through SGC to believe that they were depositing cash with SGC. Now, are you abandoning that argument?
No, Your Honor.
Then why did you say a moment ago that it didn't matter what they thought about it?
I guess I was trying to address the confusion in the case about the role of Pershing. Pershing had physical custody of customer cash that had been delivered to SGC for investment purposes, or more likely it was securities that had been legitimate securities that had been purchased or delivered to SGC and were then sold to finance the purchase of these CDs. Other customers, the money didn't go through Pershing at all. They were directed to send checks directly to the Stanford International Bank, which is what makes them more akin to Old Naples and Primeline, where the broker says, I've got a great investment opportunity for you. Here's what you do. You send your check to this guy, and that's how we buy the securities.
Why is that more akin? Because the entity that they're directed to send their funds to is not a SIFIC-covered entity.
That is correct, as was the case in Old Naples and in Primeline. But I think it's important to recognize in this case that it's very difficult to draw a distinction a meaningful distinction between any of these Stanford entities, which were all part of the scheme. They were all in on the scheme. They didn't follow corporate formalities, and the money was commingled. In fact, the money that was invested through SGC into the Stanford International Bank, much of it flowed right back to SGC, all under the control of Alan Stanford. So it's we believe that under these circumstances, it can be said that that money was deposited with SGC, was deposited with the whole group, for the purpose of buying securities. And we would also say that the securities didn't in fact exist. So it's not a case where money was invested in securities and the customer got his securities and now he's lost his SIPC coverage. The money went into the Stanford group through the broker. We are not claiming that anyone is covered who didn't have a brokerage account with SGC. That's how they got sucked into the scheme. And we believe the money, at least constructively, stayed with SGC.
You're relying in part on the fact that some of the money went back from, I'm going to call it Sybil, to SGC.
I think it's yes, we are. It's an interesting fact.
Well, it's an interesting fact, which again, some of the courts of appeals have relied on to support your argument.
Yes, Old Naples found it significant that money actually flowed back to the entity that was the SIPC member. Frankly, in a case like this, I would think that in a liquidation, there would probably be a substantive consolidation of all these entities anyway. So SGC, Sybil, it's all part of the scheme.
Can I ask you, the determination that the SEC made on June 15th, 2011, which was that customers are likely to be involved with the analysis. When are these kind of determinations ever made other than in authorizing division enforcement to bring the court action? Is there some not familiar enough with procedures at the SEC to know first how normal it is to have this kind of determination made with a pretty long and detailed explanation of the SEC's rationale and in what context are they made?
Well, this was, of course, the first time that this had ever been done in the case of a SIPA proceeding.
Aside SIPA proceedings, I guess the commission often authorizes the Division of Enforcement to bring a court case. Is this the format in which this is done? Is there some
No. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. This would be absolutely unique in my experience. So, in effect, it wasn't an enforcement action that they were authorizing. They were authorizing an action under Section 12B of SIPA, where, the Commission has authority to go into federal district court and seek an order directing SIPC to bring a proceeding.
Right. Is there a rule of SEC practice that governs when determinations like this, where the agency defines people as customers, for example, as they did in this case?
Normally it would be done in a different procedure, Your Honor, but perhaps always.
In a real rulemaking?
There would be an interpretive, what we call an interpretive release.
Uh-huh.
The process would not be, well, I take that back. The process would be somewhat different. Often interpretive releases will be circulated for comments and bear a relationship to what one would think of as rulemaking. So yes, this was a different situation.
When you say by interpretive release, this is what we would regard as an interpretive rule, which doesn't have to be subject to notice and comment, but which you apparently make available in some way to notice and comment. Is that right?
I think of them as interpretive releases rather than interpretive rules. I don't know if that has significance.
The word interpretive. What are they interpreting?
They would give guidance to the industry as to how the industry was supposed to respond to a particular statutory provision or a regulatory provision.
It would be interpreting a provision.
Yes.
And these.
So this is what we think it means. This is what we say you've got to do.
I see. Okay.
And in this case, the analysis was adopted with a fair degree of formality. So it wasn't just something that the Division of Enforcement dreamed up and...
Right. We're getting to the Chevron question, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah. So the statute says, 78C, the SEC shall have the power by rules and regulations to define technical trade and other terms used in this chapter. It says by rules and regulations. Is there any law on whether you're limited by... To doing it by rules and regulations?
I don't know. I'm not aware.
I'm not aware that
question has ever come up as to whether our agency can offer an interpretation that would be entitled to deference that wasn't by rule or regulation.
And this is the determination of June 15th is not either a rule or a regulation, I take it.
That would be my understanding, yes.
On the question of the standard for the SEC to obtain the order?
Yes.
So 78GGGB says the commission may apply for an order requiring SIPC to discharge its obligations under the chapter, right? That's what you've done. You've applied, right? So the question is, SIPC's obligations. And the section that imposes the obligation is 78EEA3, which says SIPC may file an application for a protective decree if SIPC determines that specified conditions exist. So far I'm following the line of argument correctly, right? Yes?
Yeah, I'm anticipating.
Okay, so that gives SIPC discretion, and it sounds like that suggests that they fail to discharge an obligation, which is the statute you're coming under, only if they abuse their discretion. It's not a statute that says SIPC must do this when X. It's a statute that says SIPC may do this if it determines, which sounds like you would have to show, forget about what standard or proof you'd have to use to show the abuse of discretion, that in order for there to be an obligation on corporations' part, it would have to have abused its discretion. What's wrong with that line of reasoning?
I think it seems to us that the SEC, as SIPC's plenary supervisor, we know it's the plenary supervisor because the Supreme Court said so, it doesn't make sense for the commission to have to show that SIPC had discretion and abused it, rather than that the commission also has discretion and can in effect override SIPC's determination.
Well, I think that would be right if the statute said any of those words, but the statute doesn't say any of those words. With respect to the problem that we're talking about here, it specifically says that SIPC may file an application if SIPC determines. And then it says the commission may apply for an order to require it to discharge its obligations. It doesn't say, with respect to this particular kind of obligation, that you can just substitute your judgment without showing anything. If it said, I understand the Supreme Court in general describes the review of SEC as plenary. I think that seems right. Has lots of, including the ability to impose rules on SIPC. But with respect to this particular matter and the way you're going forward, you're not doing it by a rule. You're doing it by applying for an order claiming that they failed to discharge an obligation.
Well, it certainly seems to me the case here that the reason that they refused to bring a simple liquidation was because they believed there were no customers. And the question became one of, really, of statutory interpretation. Were there customers or weren't there? How do you interpret the language of the statute and the definition of customer, which includes people who make deposits, so on and so forth? In fact, in their letter to the receiver saying, no, we don't think there is no SIPC coverage, they said, the investors got their CDs. End of story. There's nothing left in anybody's custody.
So they abused their discretion by incorrectly deciding a question of law. That's part of the standard of abuse of discretion. And that's the way you would analyze this then. There are different kinds of ways you can abuse your discretion, one of which is to be applying the wrong rule of law.
This was simply never argued as an abuse of discretion case. It was always presented as a de novo review of a legal interpretation.
Is there anything stopping the agency from the SEC from issuing a rule defining customer in the way that you want to define it here?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I mean, if it were challenged, we'd be back before people arguing that it was an unreasonable interpretation, but no.
Of course, it's subject to judicial review, but you think you could do this not by a June
yes.
determination, but by a rule?
Yes. And I suppose we could also do it by directing SIPC to adopt a similar rule.
Well, that one I have a question about, because although SIPC has authority to have rules, the one thing it doesn't have authority to do is to have rules on this subject. Isn't that right?
Oh, actually, that's an interesting question.
78CCC says that they have the power to define the terms, but not the terms for which a definition is provided in 78LLL, and that's the definition of customer.
Well, the definition of customer, but within the definition of customer, there are, of course, terms that...
But those are all in 78LLL.
Well, what about the term deposit? The question here is whether the investors had money deposited with the broker for the purpose of purchasing securities. That would make them customers.
Do you think that, leave aside your own authority, do you think...
SIPC.
Thank you. You think that SIPC could adopt a rule defining customer, let's say, in the way that you would like to define it? Could they adopt a rule?
Well, I probably shouldn't have treaded there because it's not something I've researched. I had assumed that would be one possible way of doing it. The other way that I am quite sure of is that the commission could adopt a rule. So.
All right, thank you.
On the merits question, so you started to say that, I think, that there were two steps to your argument. One is that you would treat SGC and Sybil as one and the same because of this notion that they were essentially operating as one large conglomerate. And then the second half, though, and I think you need to prevail on both.
Correct
me if I'm wrong about that.
I think that's right.
And the second half is that the CDs that were, in fact, issued, that the investors received, are not bona fide CDs or something,
right.
something to that effect. Now, as to the latter, what, and you do need one on both. As to the latter, what's your standard for telling us what a bona fide CD is, given that from what we can tell, at least Antigua seems to think that this was a bank and that the investors have a claim against the bank?
The evidence that's in the record so far seems crystal clear that it was organized, that this entity was organized under Antiguan law and purported to be a bank, not a traditional bank. It wasn't allowed to even deal with Antiguan citizens. It wasn't a bank that made loans. It was a bank that sold CDs.
But what is it about these?
To investors around the world, but had really no control over its own assets. The money didn't stay in Antigua. It went immediately to Houston or to Toronto Dominion Bank account in Canada.
But what is it about these CDs that renders them illusory? Because some of the cases you rely on, a security would be issued in the name of an entity that just doesn't even exist.
Yes.
Whereas here, the entity actually exists.
The entity exists, and not only that, the entity had printed up pieces of paper with eagles on them that said CD. We don't think that should be the thing that distinguishes these securities from securities where the fraudster wasn't smart enough, A, to set up a shell company which purported to issue the security, and B, prints up a bunch of worthless pieces of paper.
What's your standard for that, though? Because there's all kinds of really bad investments.
There are bad investments.
That just don't count. Even by your own argument, they just don't count. It's an investment as to which you're not going to be made whole because the entity that purports to have issued it is insolvent, effectively, because its liabilities far outstrip its assets.
Not only bad investments, but investments that were marketed fraudulently. That's not the case here. Here, we would maintain that these were, for all intents and purposes, simply fictions, simply part of a Ponzi scheme, which is itself a fiction.
In your argument that the representation is this is a CD on which you earn interest on the money in the CD, when in fact all the so-called interest actually comes from new subscriptions from new subscribers, as in a classic Ponzi scheme. They're not investing the money in any way.
They're not
holding the money in any way. They're just taking more money from new people and paying that money to the old people.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Your Honor.
No, but is it the case that the bank didn't gain anything on its investments? It did make investments and gain something on those investments. It's just that your argument is that it just wasn't ever going to be able to pay off on these CDs because what it was doing was largely...
As I understand the record, there were precious... Most of the money went, A, to keep the scheme afloat, and B, to finance Stanford's lavish lifestyle. There's evidence in the record that a small amount of the money was used, not necessarily by the bank per se, but by Stanford, to invest in highly speculative investments. It's unclear whether those, had they paid off, would have inured to the benefit of the bank or just to the benefit of Alan Stanford. The money was not being invested by a bank in Antigua in the hopes that it would make money on it. The money was basically stolen by Alan Stanford, and he used it for lots of things, yachts, airplanes, and speculative investments. As I understand it, that's what the record shows.
Okay. Well, on the question of whether you're stuck with the stipulation with respect to facts, your opponents suggest that you made an agreement that you would rely only on the stipulated facts and not any. What's the procedural posture of this case? It's a little confusing to me.
That's what SIPC claims. In fact, there was no such agreement. In fact, the judge said, told the parties to please agree on as many facts as you can. He wanted to simplify the case. We did, and there were plenty of other facts in the record. Now, presumably, and it hasn't really been expanded in the briefing, but presumably, if one said, well, you would have had to prove your case by a preponderance of the evidence with nothing but evidence that would normally be admissible, i.e., not declarations, affidavits, and documentary evidence, that was not substantiated by a live witness. If you took that view, then I guess you're stuck with the stipulated facts. We, of course, believed and do believe that as in this summary proceeding, we were entitled to rely on the various declarations, the various reports of the receiver that were in the record and are in the joint appendix.
And they were all put in the district court record, I take it.
Oh, yes, indeed.
Can I just ask you one more question? I don't mean to belabor the point, but on JA-239, this is the SEC's analysis.
Yes.
There's a bullet point that says that in this case, CD sale proceeds were used because sufficient assets, reserves, and investments were not available to cover the liabilities for redemptions and interest payments. Although SIBL received some returns on investments, these amounts were minuscule in comparison to the obligation. So is your assessment of the state of affairs that although apparently SIBL was getting some returns on investments, but it just was so woefully undercapitalized that the CDs were essentially valueless?
I think that's fair. I don't know the extent to which there's anything in the record about what we would call investments made by the bank for the benefit of the bank, but to the extent there were, yes, they would have been minuscule, and that's what the forensic accountant determined. The forensic accountant said there were. I think she divided it into tranches, and the smallest tranche was a tranche with highly speculative investments, but it's not clear to me whether those would have ever been under control of the bank as opposed to just part of the scheme. This was operated as a unified fraudulent scheme directed by one guy, Alan Stanford.
But what I'm trying to get a handle on is it's not enough to have fraud. I think this is under your own argument.
Yes.
It's not enough to have fraud. In other words, you could have an entity that is selling itself as making all sorts of wonderful investments, and you ought to invest in us because you can be rest assured that our CDs are going to be good because we're making these incredible investments. They turn out to be really, really bad investments, and there's a lot of fraud in the way that they're advertising those investments. But that's not in itself enough, because that would be a fraud case. That wouldn't be a case in which the CD that was ultimately issued was non-bona fide. There's something else that's going on here that renders it non-bona fide in your view, which you think you have to show.
And this, that's right.
And the something, how would you define the something else? What's your standard for the something else that's going on that would allow a determination that these CDs should be treated as if they were illusory as opposed to just really, really bad ideas?
I have given this thought, and I'm not sure that I have a great answer for you. It seems to me one would have to look at a variety of circumstances, probably the best being a question of intent. Oftentimes you see operations where people are actually trying to make investments, maybe bad investments, maybe they're hoping that by lying about the value of the investments, they can keep the operation afloat, that sort of thing. There may be operations that have assets producing oil wells, just, you know, not producing very much. There you would say it was a real security, but it's being fraudulently marketed. It's difficult in a Ponzi scheme to see anything other than the money. Mm-hmm. In fact, I think there's a quote in the analysis from the trustee in the Madoff case saying it's just the money. That's all you look at is the money.
So it's kind of a Ponzi scheme exception. I mean, your argument is that this is a Ponzi scheme. There's a thing that we can identify called a Ponzi scheme that has some legal significance to it. And when you're in the zone of a Ponzi scheme, you treat the CDs that are issued as if they...
Well, yes. I mean, it would be more than a Ponzi scheme exception. I mean, you could have a case that we wouldn't call a Ponzi scheme that was just a dishonest broker who said, have I got a deal for you? It's the Brooklyn Bridge. And you'd say, no, that's just completely fictitious.
You count that
one,
too.
I'm not sure that Ponzi is the distinguishing factor as much as whether there was any real substance to the investment or whether... It was anything there was mere window dressing. There was plenty of window dressing in this case. Okay. If there are no further questions.
Okay.
please the court. I think as this argument so far has indicated that the case hinges on the scope of coverage under the Securities Investor Protection Act, SIPA. The scope of coverage is primarily defined in the customer definition. It was carefully crafted to limit this statute and access to the SIPA fund to the return of property which is on deposit with the broker at the time of insolvency. It was not intended and does not extend to losses due to investment losses, even if those are caused by fraud, even if those are caused by the fraud of the broker involved. I think the easiest way to go about this might be simply to turn to the definition of customer in the statute and talk about it in some detail. This is 78LLL2, which if you don't have it in front of you, you can see it at page A6 of the statutory appendix to SIPC's brief. So this statute, and it has an included persons section, which tells you who's in, and then there are two exclusions. Now, both of those exclusions are relevant, but let's begin with the basic definition in B, which provides that a customer includes any person who has deposited cash with the debtor for the purpose of purchasing securities. Now, there are two things about that to call attention to. One is that the deposit has to be with the debtor, which in this case is the SIPC member, SGC. There was no deposit of money with SGC in this case. The deposit of money was either with Pershing or, most of it, with the Antiguan Bank. When the investors here opened accounts with the Antiguan Bank, a bank which, by the way, is not subject to the securities laws of the United States, does not pay into the SIPA fund, does not report earnings to the IRS, and pays.
But there have been cases that have consolidated a broker dealer, the SIPC covered one, and another non-SIPC covered one, when they've discovered either that the intent of the claimant was to put the money in the covered broker dealer, but there was a misrepresentation about whether that was happening, and also where the money came back around from the non-covered broker dealer to the covered broker dealer.
Your Honor, there has never been a case in which substantive consolidation was used for the purpose of finding customer status to open a litigation. The substantive consolidation is a remedial doctrine, an equitable remedial doctrine that makes available the assets of all of these various related entities to satisfy the claims of victims. It has never been used in order to show that there are customers for purposes of tapping into the SIPA fund, and there's a good reason for that.
Can I pause over that?
Sure.
In New Times, the court says that SIPC approved consolidating the estates of the broker-dealer and the non-broker-dealer and treating all the customers as customers of both.
But that was there were undisputably customers in that case.
Well,
so that has to do with how to handle the...
Some were customers of the covered broker-dealer and some were covered customers of the non-covered. And yet they were all treated as customers of both, including, therefore, of the covered one.
Again, not for purposes of initiating a liquidation. May I just, the reason for this, the reason this has to be so, is that SIPC needs to be able to tell in advance what the nature of the coverage is in order to price the insurance and determine, you know, what exactly its potential liability is. And this kind of determination has to be made before, and in order to avoid the moral hazard of covering entities and activities without having any payments being made on their behalf into the fund.
Can I just ask, though, in New Times it says, as a result, with the approval, I'm reading from the Second Circuit, with the approval of SIPC, irrespective of whether they had dealt with New Times, the broker-dealer entity, or New Age, the non-broker dealer entity, it was consolidated, and then it said, customer claims have been determined according to SIPA, and the debtor for SIPA purposes includes both New Times and New Age for claims. So is that not what I've described, or am I misunderstanding?
I'm not sure. But there is a specific exception not applicable in New Times, which is applicable here.
Exclusion.
The specific exclusion that claims based upon, you see here the exclusion is in C1, any claim arising out of a transaction with a foreign subsidiary of a member of SIPC is specifically excluded. New Times is a completely domestic situation.
Let me put that aside just for the moment. But all of these cases do sound like, I'm not saying that they could do it in this case, but it does sound like that courts have thought it reasonable to consolidate the covered and the non-covered. And that if the SEC were to have done this by a rule, we would have a Chevron problem in terms of question of whether this was reasonable or not reasonable. Your position is that it's not reasonable to have, that there's no reasonable interpretation, not only that it's not the right interpretation, but that there's no reasonable interpretation that would have allowed a consolidation here and a treatment of all these people as customers?
The SIPC's position is that it is vested in SIPC the authority to determine whether there are customers who are in need of protection. And that SIPC did that according to the law in existence at the time. There is no such regulation as you hypothesize. And indeed, we believe that both of the specific exclusions take this case outside of any general principle of that sort. Not only are we talking about a foreign entity, and the dangers here of extending coverage to entities that are not regulated and not subject to liquidation by SIPC are enormous. In fact, it's difficult to imagine what it would mean to include a foreign entity or a foreign affiliate of an American broker, since the central feature of this statute is that SIPC puts them into liquidation. SIPC does not have the authority to put into liquidation foreign banks. In fact, to this day, the Antiguan authorities have still not agreed to put the Antiguan bank into liquidation.
Was there no individual who had funds on deposit with SGC that were then used to purchase SIBL CDs?
No, Your Honor, there was not. The money comes, I think my friend from the SEC described this quite accurately. The money invested in Civil came from two different places. According to the joint stipulation, which one would think is the principal source here, the investors either made out checks so that's their own money out of their own checking accounts, presumably, that were sent to Civil, or they offered wire transfers. They authorized wire transfers.
Some of that money may
have been on deposit with Pershing, but none of it was on deposit with SGC.
How do we know that?
Well, we know that, I mean, for one thing, the district court tells us that when it says that SGC is the introducing broker rather than Pershing, right?
So let me ask a question about that, the mechanics of that. So if I have money on deposit at SGC, and my SGC liaison tells me, you ought to invest in this Civil CD, it's a great product. And then I say, fine, go ahead and do that. And then the way that happens is, my money gets taken out of my SGC account, sent to Pershing, and then Pershing purchases the CD. Is SGC, am I not a customer of SGC? Because it's true that the money went through Pershing
before
getting the CD.
You're not, in fact, what you've just described is exactly the factual circumstances in New Times 2 in the Second Circuit, where investors had money on deposit with the brokerage, and they are ill-advised by that same broker to remove money from deposit and then lend it back to that very same broker, right? So we don't have any problem of consolidation. It's the very same broker. They lend it to the broker who is running a Ponzi scheme. They receive a promissory note with ridiculous amounts of nominal interest provided. And what the Second Circuit holds is that this is, they are not customers of the broker, that they fall within that second exclusion, which is C2, because when you lend money to the entity, it is a part of that money becomes part of the capital of the debtor. It is no longer a customer account being held on deposit by the broker. It is, becomes a loan to the broker. So even if we imagine that Sybil is part of the same entity here, the transaction involved is a purchase of a CD, which is a debt instrument. The receiver in this April 2009 report specifically stated that these CDs are debt instruments and not brokerage accounts with Sybil. And under the logic of the New Times 2 decision, they are simply not customers.
You're never a customer of that entire transaction, even for the instant in time in which you have the money ready to be.
Well, you cease to be a customer when you remove your funds from being on deposit in your brokerage account and instead lend it to the broker in the Ponzi scheme. And again, I think this follows from the language of B1, because it's once when a person has deposited cash with the debtor for purposes of purchasing securities, once the securities have been purchased, the money is no longer on deposit. Then they have a security, right? And if that security happens to be fraudulent, if it happens to be a terrible investment for any reason, including the fraudulent assurances of the broker, it is outside the coverage of SEPA.
So I want to go back to.
Go ahead.
I just want to go back to these cases. In addition to New Times, Primeline, and Old Maple, so I looked again, and they all do appear to be on exactly the subject of whether, for purposes of SIPA, cash is deposited with the debtor, for purposes of SIPA, whether it's a customer. I'm just going to read you these lines from each of them. Primeline, if a claimant intended to have the brokerage purchase security on the claimant's behalf and reasonably followed the broker's instructions regarding payment, the claimant is a customer under SIPA, even if the brokerage or its agents misappropriated the funds, even if, quote, checks were not made out to Primeline or its clearing broker, and even if, quote, Primeline did not actually receive the funds. So that sounds like there is an exception here, at least there was in the Primeline case, for treating both the SIPA covered and the non-SIPA covered entity as one.
I don't think so, Your Honor. The key thing about Primeline and the thing that makes it controversial is that you had an agent of the SIPC member, an agent of the broker who's dealing with the investors. The investors think that they're giving their money to him to go into the to an account in the brokerage. They take all the reasonable steps to do that. He steals the money before it gets to the brokerage. Now, a narrow interpretation of the statute, a technical and I think literally correct interpretation of the statute, is that when the money is stolen before it is ever on deposit with the brokerage, the SIPA does not apply. The court held otherwise in Primeline, and we don't. For this case, we don't need to challenge that. But all of the only heterodox aspect of Primeline is that it holds that the conversion of the investor's money counts under SIPA, even when it was converted by the agent of the broker before it goes on deposit. Note that is. It could not be more different
there are some of these affidavits that say that the investors thought they were putting the money into SGC. I'm not saying all of them, and that seems like a fact question, but assume there were some who there were misrepresentations made to them, and they thought they were giving the money to SGC. Why is that different than the ones who thought they were giving to Primeline, but even when they wrote checks to the non-covered entity?
The point here is, did they take all reasonable steps? Look at what they did in this case. In Primeline, they filled out the new account forms with Primeline. In this case, they filled out new account forms with the Antiguan Bank. In this case, they were given disclosure statements. Clearly, and in fact, this is part of the joint stipulation, they are given disclosure statements that tell them quite clearly that the Antiguan Bank is not regulated under U.S. securities laws and is not covered under SIPC. They go ahead and do it anyway. They then make out their own checks, which is unlike Primeline, where the agent of the broker is managing the money for them. Here they make out their own checks to the Antiguan Bank.
Do we know
Bank.
This about every one of these? I mean, this case was really decided, in what must be regarded as a summary proceeding. For example, when one of these witnesses says that the broker referred to all the Stanford companies as simply Stanford, all the marketing materials I saw displayed the same Stanford Eagle logo. There was never any differentiation between the companies. They were always the Stanford group of companies. I was assured that the bank was insured by SIPC. I never received the certificate. Are all those facts resolved in this case? And are they all irrelevant?
We have to go through each one, yeah. But most of them, as I hear, yes. The fact, some of them say that they didn't receive the certificate. The joint stipulations say that they did, and to the extent that any of them didn't, the SEC is not relying upon that fact in this case. So I think we can assume that they did receive their certificate. The disclosure statements are in the record, and the disclosure statements clearly state that the money is being deposited with Sybil, and that it is not being deposited with SGC, and SGC is not liable for a repayment. It could not be more clear.
Is there evidence in the record that they all received those disclosure statements? All the possible claimants?
The word all is not in the joint stipulation. Mm-hmm. That they did receive the disclosures is.
So you think the SEC agrees that they all received them?
I think the SEC is running away from the joint stipulations. What the joint stipulation says is that it says in the United States, this is joint stipulation 6, in the United States, disclosure statements for Sybil CDs stated. Now, it doesn't say all, but it says that they did. It doesn't say some. I think this is a fair, these are the facts under which the case was being litigated, is that the disclosure statements provided to these investors made these assertions. So in Primeline, what the investors thought they were doing and took all reasonable steps to do was to put their money on deposit with the SIPC member. In this case, what the investors thought they were doing and were told they were doing and intended to do and did was to put their money in this offshore entity outside of the coverage of the securities laws. And so the equities here are so different, right? These are, in one case you have American investors who do everything right and think that they have an account in an American firm, and in the other, you have people who, in the face of disclosure statements, clearly to the contrary, go off to an offshore bank seeking what the SEC's IG described as outlandishly high rates of return, knowing that it's not covered by the securities laws, knowing that they're not paying into SIPA, right? Knowing that the tax authorities are going to know nothing about what their earnings are, and then when things go sour, they come back and expect the legitimate investors of America to insure this. Think of the moral hazard involved in this. Effectively, what the SEC is telling us is that SIPC should implicitly give free insurance coverage to a fly-by-night organization that, that operates outside of our laws.
Can I ask you a question about where we are in the context of the overall argument? And what I mean to say is this, that if we consider the entities to be one and the same, perhaps per the statements in some of these cases and the like, then the argument that the SEC is making is that then the person has deposited cash with the debtor. Because the debtor is SGC, we're considering SGC and SIBL to be the same. And then they would have deposited cash.
But not deposited. What they've done is invested. If you assume that they're all one, what they've done is they've invested in the debtor. They have lent money to the debtor. And that is specifically excluded from coverage under C2 and the logic of the New Times 2 decision. So either way we look at it, consolidate or not, it's still outside the coverage. If we don't consolidate, then what we have here is no money on deposit with the SIPC member. And if we do consolidate, then what we have is a loan to
I get that argument based on the second exclusion, and I guess it presupposes that when you're considering an entity that's a joint broker-dealer and bank, that the bank part of it takes precedence over the broker-dealer. That's the way you're doing it under exclusion 2. I understand that argument. I think the SEC would probably say, well, you look at that same joint entity and the dealer part of it takes precedence over the bank part of it. But just bear with me for 1 second and put that to one side. Even if that hurdle can be overcome, then you have another argument, I think, which is that none of this matters because no matter what, the investors got a CD. Am I right in understanding that that's an independent, freestanding argument, that even if you consider the entities to be joint and that deposits were then made and you overcome the hurdle, which you rightly raised, which is that deposits are not deposits at this point, they're actually loans, but let's put that to one side, then do you have an independent argument to the effect that none of this matters because the individuals nonetheless got a CD?
Yes, it has to do with whether there has been a deposit, because once the money that is given to the broker, even on deposit, is actually used for the purchase of securities, it's no longer on deposit. So once they receive their security, now it could be that the security is on deposit with the broker. That's what often happens with brokerage accounts.
But here the CD
went to the individual, and so nothing's on deposit. The money isn't on deposit because it was used to purchase the CD. The CD is not on deposit because they have it.
Now, as to that part of the argument, which it seems to me is your sort of last fail-safe argument, if I'm understanding the kind of sequence of arguments correctly, then what the SEC would say is that it doesn't make any sense to treat these CDs as bona fide CDs for that purpose because the whole purpose of the scheme was to give somebody something that's valueless. And on that, it does seem a little bit strange to say that in a case in which an individual gets a piece of paper for a fictitious entity, we're going to kind of treat that as if it never happened. But an individual gets a piece of paper for a real entity, but everybody understood from the outset that this was valueless and effectively garbage, then why should we treat that as sacrosanct?
Because if we don't, we collapse the statute into coverage for fraud. You can make exactly the same. This was fraud. It isn't as if, I mean, so this is a real CD, right? It is an actual legal claim on a real entity. This bank exists under the law of Antigua. It has offices all over the world.
Define for me, how would you, what are the steps that would lead me to the conclusion that this is a real CD?
Well, let me say, in the cases involving fictitious CDs, there is no entity that the security doesn't, no money passed outside of the brokerage into another entity. There is no other entity. This is an actual entity. It's, of course, a fraud. It's a Ponzi scheme, but we don't cover fraud. Right, but it exists. These certificates have value. There are assets. The receivers in the two, both in Texas and in Antigua, have been gathering together the assets. They're over $300 million in assets. Just last week, the Antiguan receiver made a public announcement that they would be paying, that the receiver would be paying out dividends on these CDs. Of course, we're talking pennies on the dollar, but they are not fictitious. They are real legal claims. And it is really strange to hear the SEC declaring that these pieces of paper are fictitious when they go to such efforts, commendable efforts, right, to try to provide as many assets as possible to redeem them. And the other side of this is in cases like Primeline, right, where you have an actual fictitious claim, the money never went anywhere. Here the money went to the Antiguan Bank. Now, of course, they point out that some of that money came back to SGC. What the record shows is it comes back to SGC in the form of commissions, incentives, referral fees. Right? It does not come back.
I thought their argument is it came back to pay expenses of SGC. Is that wrong?
Some of that is used. They say some of it is used, but the reasons why the money goes back are commissions, referral fees, and incentives.
Well, commissions, referral fees involving two companies that are all owned by Mr. Stanford, right? So whether there's real fees there or not.
That may be, but the point is that the money is not cash being deposited in SGC for the purpose of purchasing securities.
Whether
the companies are interconnected or not, it's this flow of money back does not make the money a deposit in SGC. In
Old Naples, the court does rely in part on the fact that the money did come back to pay the brokerage's expenses. Is Old Naples just wrong or unreasonable?
I just think the facts there are quite different because there you have you basically have accounts with companies that have the same, almost the same name, right? And they are quite literally the same entity. The money is being.
You're talking about an Old Naples, right?
An Old Naples.
I would say that's what the SEC claims. You have two companies with almost the same name. Both have the word Stanford as the first word. Both are owned by Mr. Stanford. Both are part of one big Ponzi scheme. Why is that different?
Well, it's in. May I cite New Times too? It is literally the same broker, but when the money is going back in a different capacity, that is buying a promissory note, as it's put in New Times too, or a certificate of deposit, as we have here, it is a debt instrument. It is not a security. And so the money is no longer it is not a brokerage account. And the statute specifically excludes from its coverage claims that are based upon debt instruments.
Can you talk briefly about two subjects we haven't really talked about? One is the Chevron question. The other is what the standard proof is supposed to be. So, as I'm reading the statute, 78BBB of SIPA says the provisions of the Securities Exchange Act apply to SIPA as if this chapter was included as a section of such act. Then 78C of that act says the SEC shall have power by rules and regulations to define technical trade and other terms used in this chapter. So this is usually unlike the restriction on SIPA, on SIPSI, which is in 78CCC and is restricted, where SIPSI is not allowed, SIPIC is not allowed to define the terms customer, etc. There's no such limitation on the SEC. So normally the first question in a Chevron question in a Chevron case is, does the agency been given congressional authority? And this sounds like they've been given congressional authority. Now, they may have exceeded their authority, but sounds like they've been given authority to define the terms.
I don't think so. Let me just offer an alternative reading of the statute. Yeah. If you look at 78 CCC 3, it's talking about the action of the commission. So SIPC is given authority to issue rules and bylaws, including rules defining terms in the statute that are not otherwise specifically defined. And then
which provision? We're both missing it.
I'm actually referring to two different provisions. SIPC has the power. This is in 78. let's see here. CCC B4.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The SIPC has the power in general to issue rules defining terms if not otherwise defined.
Other than those terms for
right, and other than those otherwise defined.
Defined
in the statute.
Right.
Now, the SEC's power right. under SIPA, mm-hmm. Which is in CCC 3, the very last bit of CCC, the SEC's power is that they can either veto SIPC's rules or they may require SIPC to adopt rules. Now, the way I read this is that this is a very specific provision in SIPA which does not give the SEC itself the power to issue rules defining SIPA. SIPC issues those rules, and what the SEC's power is to require SIPC to do so.
What about, I thought that was right until I saw 78BBB.
I conclude is that neither SIPC nor the SEC has the authority to issue rules defining the terms that Congress has defined.
So what do you do with 78BBB, which says that the provisions of the Securities Exchange Act apply to SEPA as if this chapter was included as a section of that act, of SEPA? And then 78C gives the SEC the power to define the terms. So even though SIPC couldn't define it, and even though SEC can't make SIPC adopt a rule defining it, the SEC has the power to make the rule itself.
Your Honor, I'm not saying that this is not ambiguous. I do think that the better reading of the statute, when you look at the entire thing as, you know, and treating SIPA as if it's an amendment to the securities laws in general, that when SIPC is given the power to define the terms of this part of the law, and the SEC is confined to ordering them to issue rules, I think that's more specific and that controls over the more general language of the rest of the Act. I'm not claiming that that's the only possible way to read it. I think it's the most sensible way, because why would Congress, what Congress is evidently doing here is saying that our definitions of these statutory terms are clear enough and we don't want the expert agencies involved adding to it.
If that were, assuming you're wrong, and I'm not saying you are, but assuming you were, why isn't the, and therefore that we move to the next step, why isn't the determination that the agency made in June of 2011 was considerably more fulsome with respect to its explanation of its reasoning for its interpretation of the word customer? Why would we not give that Chevron deference, assuming the agency has the power to define
it? Well, for several reasons. First, the term customer is not ambiguous. I think you get caught up at Chevron step one. I can't even tell from the SEC's briefs what they think the definition of customer is. What they seem to be saying is that if the equities are strong enough, we should be able to move beyond the definition of customer. And in their reply, toward the end of their reply brief, it looks as though it's this kind of totality of the circumstances, because when in response to our point that their definition would seem to open up SIPA to virtually any claim of fraud by the broker, SEC's response to that is, oh, no, there are, you know, five or six different facts here that in the totality of the circumstances add up to coverage. That doesn't look like a statutory definition that could be due any kind of Chevron deference. In addition to that, it was not adopted in either a rulemaking or an adjudication. And although that's not a hard and fast rule, and it comes pretty close.
Well, not in the circuit. I just did a Westlaw search maybe a dozen times in just the last few years. We say that it's not required. We give deference to relatively formal opinion letters, all kinds of things.
Well, you'll note that there is no definition of customer in the analysis provided by the SEC. So I don't know what it is that you would defer to. Then there's the fact that, at worst, there are two different agencies involved. I mean, SIPC, let me be clear. SIPC is a nonprofit corporation, but it is entirely headed by executive branch employees. Five of the directors are appointed by the president with advice and consent of the Senate. The other two come from Treasury and the Federal Reserve. They unanimously voted that this was not covered by the statute. And Chevron, this court has extended Chevron deference to entities like the Legal Services Corporation, Amtrak, and other entities that are also government-created corporations. And so I think at worst you have two agencies with differing interpretations.
The Legal Services Corporation relied on the fact that Congress gave them authority to issue rules on the subject, and here specifically says they can't issue rules on the subject. So it makes that comparison
again,
problematic.
I think the best reading is that SEC can't either.
Okay. Let me just one more on the standard of review. So what do you make of the colloquy I had with opposing counsel about whether abuse of discretion is the appropriate standard of review?
This
is not standard of review, but the standard that the agency has to prove.
Well, we agree with that. It seems, the determination is, the word is may, and by the way, the legislative history specifically says in its discretion, and to the extent that legislative history matters, it is a discretionary matter. I think the reason why it wasn't argued in these terms here, in discretionary terms here, is because SIPC's view was that it was a legal determination, and as you point out, one of the elements of abuse of discretion is making an error of law, and so it didn't seem to matter in this particular case.
If it were the standard, would we still have to ask abuse of discretion proven by what burden? Would we still have to say abuse of discretion as shown by preponderance of the evidence, or is that the end? This is too getting to be too meta of a question about standards.
I think if one were to start over again and just try to figure out what the statute is saying, it might actually be whether SIPC has substantial evidence to support its conclusion on an analogy to administrative law. But that hasn't been what we've argued, and I'm not suggesting that the court would go there now. The fact is that the statute doesn't specify the burden of proof. The default burden of proof in civil litigation is preponderance of the evidence.
If it were substantial evidence, that really wouldn't be much different than probable cause, would it, really?
It would be flipped the other way, though. Yeah. The question is whether SIPC has substantial evidence.
Yes.
Because it's SIPC's determination, and the SEC has to show that SIPC has violated its legal obligations. But the statutes are not worded in terms of probable cause. If you read the entire SIPA, it's clear that Congress, in some cases, did speak in terms of probabilities or risks, but not in the key provisions we're talking about here. When under the SEC's enforcement authority, the provision says, in the event that SIPC has failed to act for the protection of customers, in the event that it has failed, it doesn't say in case there might be customers, in case there is a risk of this, it's that in the event that they have failed. That does not sound like probable cause.
Can I take you back to the Chevron question for just one second, which is, You've made the point that in the SEC's analysis, it's hard to find out what the definition of customer is that they're relying on. But they at least established the following proposition, it seems like, which is that someone can be a customer even if he or she initially deposited those funds with an entity other than the broker-dealer. That's stated several times in the course of the SEC's analysis. So wouldn't we, insofar as this analysis is something as to which Chevron deference would otherwise apply, wouldn't we at least extend Chevron to that conclusion? And that's your main basis for distinguishing the cases that the Chief Judge is relying on.
In that section of the analysis, they are providing an interpretation of Primeline and Old Naples, and that doesn't, and when you see it in that light, the money was entrusted to an agent of the SIPC member with the understanding that it was being deposited with the SIPC member. That doesn't mean you can deposit it any which way.
So your argument would just be that that's just not entitled to deference because it's an unreasonable reading of the statute.
I think that Primeline and Old Naples, at heart, are agency cases. That is, they're saying that when someone is acting as an agent for the broker and they and the people that they're dealing with do what they say, that the broker is responsible for the actions of its agent. I don't think it goes any farther than that.
Okay, thank you. We'll hear from the SEC.
Thank you.
I'll be brief because there's been plenty of discussion of all the issues, it seems to me. The one thing I did want to touch on is the notion that the investors would somehow be converted into lenders as opposed to investors. This issue has come up a number of times. I think probably the best place to look is the C.J. Wright case, which was a bankruptcy court opinion. But it really has to do with investment intent. These investors weren't intending to loan money.
Why do you say that? I'm not quite sure I understand that. So they bought a certificate of deposit,
which is defined by SIPA to be a security.
But it's also a loan. Is it not a loan to the bank?
It
which the bank has to repay.
The case law certainly finds that these sort of securities that are made, that are bought with an investment intent as opposed to a lending intent, nevertheless qualify for SIPC coverage and do not make the customer simply a general creditor of the
So if it's a situation like I'm assuming that Wells Fargo acts both as an issuer of CDs and as a broker-dealer, and is the SEC's view that if an individual buys a CD with Wells Fargo, they have an account with Wells Fargo in their brokerage connotation, but they buy a CD with Wells Fargo that they're that creates a creditor-debtor relationships, or you're saying that
I mean, under the statute itself, it says it's a security, not a loan. I mean, it's not an equity security, but it would be a security that was purchased with an investment intent. In your Wells Fargo case, I doubt if the Wells Fargo depositor examines the creditworthiness of Wells Fargo before deciding whether to buy a CD. In any event, this has come up a number of times. In fact, I think it came up in the Primeline case as well.
The SEC's analysis doesn't actually give the same answer you're giving. It says there's no evidence that the Sybil CD purchasers intended to loan money to or otherwise invest in SGC. Mr. McConnell's argument is that if you consolidate SGC with Sybil, they did intend to loan money to Sybil. That's a different argument. You're saying a CD purchaser never intend, even in a completely non-fraudulent, above-the-board CD, that the CD purchaser doesn't intend to loan money to the entity that gives it the CD?
No, and not such that it would convert the person from a out of customer status under SIPA and into general creditor status. That's the point here.
Well, which other than Wright, which is just, to be fair, it's a bankruptcy court opinion without control over us.
Sure.
What else is, I mean, this in a normal bank, is it not the case that the depositors' accounts, which are regarded as part of the capital of the bank, do they not add to the capital of the bank? Or do they not?
Depositor accounts?
Yeah, a CD. If a depositor buys a CD from the bank and the bank holds it.
I don't think that adds to the capital of the bank.
Okay, so then there's no argument here at all. This is just all just simply wrong. It's not an intent or not intent. It just means CDs are never part of the capital of the entity.
I think CDs are not, a normal deposit certainly wouldn't be. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the treatment is for a CD. The CD is an investment. And I have no idea what the rules are for the use of the proceeds by the bank.
Okay. What about the other exclusion? The claim arises out of a transaction with a foreign subsidiary of a member of SIPC.
Well, we don't understand the relevance of that. I mean, it's not a transaction with a foreign subsidiary. This isn't a subsidiary. And it's our view that this is all one Ponzi scheme located in the United States. Money may have been channeled offshore for a very short time. My understanding is checks were sent. When people bought their CDs by sending personal checks, the checks were actually sent to Antigua and immediately bundled up and sent back to
So there's no there there in Antigua? There's no buildings, no offices, no bank, no money? It's just a lie. Is that right?
I think they had an office, a small office. Uh-huh. I don't believe it was staffed. Uh-huh. The president
was immediately sent back to SGC?
My understanding is yes. No, not to SGC, to the Stanford Group. The foreignness does not seem to us to be dispositive of anything here. It doesn't seem to me that that's the grounds upon which you get out of SIPA coverage. Simply because there's an exclusion for transactions with foreign subsidiaries. This isn't a subsidiary.
And is it accurate to say that all of the claimants did receive these disclaimers that are referred to in the stipulated facts? Or at least that you're not contesting that they all got the disclaimers?
The stipulated facts, as I recall, say that we're not contesting that that people didn't receive the phony securities, and the phony securities did, in fact, as far as we know, include the disclaimer.
So everybody got a disclaimer saying you won't be.
As far as I know, for purposes of our argument, of course, they got the disclaimer after they had made the investment. So, query what good it would have done.
I see. So the disclosure statements weren't sent before.
My understanding was that the disclosures that were talking about were contained in two documents. One would be the CD itself, so that says this is we're not affiliated with SIPC. And then there was a disclosure document. I don't know that the record demonstrates who did or didn't get the disclosure document. And that so was the promotional materials.
The stipulation says a version of the marketing brochures. It talks about the disclosure statements for the CDs, and then it goes on to say a version of the marketing brochures for simple CDs. Stated that civil CDs are not subject to the reporting requirements of any jurisdiction outside of Antigua and Barbuda.
But I don't think it says that we agree that everybody got that. I may be wrong.
It doesn't say that.
We do agree that everybody got the CD, which had the...
Okay. So your distinction between the marketing brochure and the CD.
The marketing brochure and the CD are different. Yeah. Some people...
For purposes of whether everybody got
it. Some people would have gotten the brochure, presumably. Others presumably wouldn't have. Probably depended what the broker needed in order to make the sale.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
I will take the case under submission. Thank you.